Hi, and welcome to the Decoding Culture Podcast. The podcast focuses on the importance that culture plays in all areas of business and society, from how it shapes organizations, work, to how it influences consumer experience, innovation, design, and larger societal trends. My name is John Curran, and I'm your host. I'm a business anthropologist, executive coach, and CEO of JC Associates, which is a consultancy that helps businesses develop better working cultures and relationships with their consumers. Does the mind shape who we are, how we think, and the decisions we make, the moral paths we take? Well, that is what Western thought has led us to believe, after all. But what about the body? Is it simply a shadow of the greatness of the mind, or could we be learning more about human behavior, culture, and society by giving the body equal importance? To unravel this, I spoke with the world-renowned business anthropologist, Dr. Simon Roberts, about his new book, The Power of Not Thinking, How Our Bodies Learn and Why We Should Trust Them. And we looked at how the concept of embodied knowledge is essential to understanding human behavior. We explore how the concept should be central to how business leaders think and how we understand our connections to technology and other areas of society and culture. So let's jump into episode 3. Simon, welcome to the Decoding Culture podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Great. It's brilliant to have you. I kind of seem to start with all my guests. I like to kind of locate where they are. And we were supposed to be sitting in your lovely office in Southwark, a stone's throw away from Borough Market and London Bridge. But we're not because of what seems to be a drawn-out semi-lockdown beginning to rumble in London on the 23rd of September 2020. So where are you, Simon?
I am in Southwark. I'm on the top floor of our old warehouse office, and looking out some rain rain on both sides, but looking south of the river one way and over my shoulder the good old city of London.
I have been there, and it's a wonderful office, but there is definitely that autumnal kind of London feel of dark clouds and wind that seems to be transcending onto us. But Simon, it's wonderful to have you on the pod. I think it'll be really helpful for the listeners to get a sense about who you are, and especially your kind of journey as a business anthropologist. So just getting a little bit of an overview of that.
Yeah, potted history. So yes, I read anthropology at university, did a PhD, which explored the satellite TV revolution in mid-1990s India. Decided I wanted to try my luck at being an anthropologist outside of academia, and wound up running a little company called Ideas Bazaar that did work for think tanks and technology companies and for media companies in the early 2000s, before moving over to Intel to run an innovation group looking at health for their digital health business, which I focused on aging really for most of my time there, and set up the company Strike Partners back in 2013. I've just taken on a role as a board president of Epic, and Epic is the ethnographic praxis in industry community, which hosts a conference once a year and also runs an all-year, round-year site with learning, coaching classes, and content for a growing community of practitioners in this space.
Okay, and Strike Partners, of course, I know Strike Partners. We're fellow business anthropologists. We sit in a very broad, similar field. And I guess if you're looking at that history of the use of anthropology in the world of innovation and management and business, it always had that kind of positioning of research, but there's something about Stripe Partners, if it goes beyond that. Well, how would you describe the type of work Stripe Partners does?
Well, actually, I mean, I think we've always been proud to call ourselves a research business at some levels, because that's at the heart of everything that we do, and we value, you know, the craft of research in a world in which, you know, often people want to be strategic or they want to be something else. We want to be research heavy. We want to be research led in what we do. But the sort of advice we give our clients is ultimately focuses on short-term through to long-term kind of product and business strategy questions. We've got a fairly heavy leaning towards tech clients, and at least pre-COVID, a specific take on how best to work with our clients and our customers. And it's actually something, you know, I could talk about in the context of the motivation for writing the book. But we've got this sort of very hands-on philosophy of taking people out into the world with us, partly because not just me, but my colleagues here all believe in the power of embodied knowledge.
Okay, and that's something we're going to – it was a lovely kind of little kind of a segue into the main bulk of why I want to – interview for the podcast. And the power of not thinking how our bodies learn and why we should trust them is your latest book, a book that I've read. It's kind of rare that you get a thought piece book / business book that becomes more of a page turner. You know, I kind of find that sometimes I read these books and they're great and they're nuggets in there that help me, but it's usually the first you know, a few chapters or it's a skimmer I can get through. But this was something I felt I couldn't really miss out page by page. It was fascinating. But we're going to go into it. But I want to know what kind of spurred you on to write this book?
Well, first of all, it's kind of you say it was a page turner. I was heavily encouraged to write a book that was accessible to a wide audience. But, yeah, the motivations, I mean, I suppose primarily, you know, and foremost as an anthropologist, you know, I've always been interested in the knowledge that's beyond words. The idea that people know, as a philosopher, Polanyi said, people know more than they can tell. And I've always been fascinated with that idea that there's knowledge that we can readily explain to anyone that asks us about the worlds that we live in, and then there's some knowledge which is sort of beyond the tips of our tongues. So I was interested long term in that sort of knowledge and all the ways in which it shows up in our lives. In the context of the business, I think there were two sort of sources of frustration that led me to want to write the book. The first was that, yeah, for all consultancies advising their clients, there's this question of how will they believe what it is we tell them about the world, or how should we best communicate what it is we've discovered about the world in a way that will enable impact. And I've long thought that often the answer to that very difficult question for a lot of companies is, let's make the PowerPoint deck even more beautiful, let's create posters, let's make a video, let's do all this great communication work, but something is still missing. And for me, that missing bit is the power of experience. And I wanted to understand, you know, what goes on in an experience that allows it to have such enduring power for people. And the final observation or motivation is, you know, we live in a world in which big data is very dominant. You know, everyone talks about being data-led, about their data strategies, the data everywhere. And I think it has a set of characteristics and qualities as a way of knowing the world, which are useful, but not sufficient. And I think it's the job of experience to help us hang a framework, hang data on a framework, which is based on on our first-hand understanding of the world. So again, you know, what is it that we can learn about the world by exposing our bodies to it that could then help us make sense of the data that others can provide about the world around us?
It's kind of one thing that kind of was definitely taken. You went straight for the kind of big question, which I really enjoyed reading, because you seem to unpack it through the book. But you know, you might want to kind of challenge a theory here and there, but you go straight for Descartes and this idea of the body is a kind of poor relation to the mind. Mm-hmm. Intelligence or Western intelligence or notions of intelligence and rationalism it's all in the mind, and the body is just this kind of shadow. You kind of almost tip that upside down. I'm just kind of wondering your thinking behind that.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose at some levels, it goes back to the idea of trying to write a book that's, that it's accessible. And, I suppose at some levels, it's a rhetorical device, right? That, everybody sort of need an enemy, you need a baddie. And at some levels, it's not, it's not necessarily a new claim. I certainly wouldn't claim that it is, that Descartes is kind of responsible for this original sin, as it were, of putting mind over body. I mean, there's a great deal of work that's been done over the years, that's been shaped by that idea and shaped in response to that idea. But it seemed like an obvious and accessible place to start. But the more you sort of dig into the critiques of Descartes and, his influence and legacy, I think the thing that fascinated me was I discovered how many other disciplines are all pushing against, this Cartesian notion of mind and body. And so it turns up, this reversal, as it were, or this other way of thinking about the role of the body turns up in cognitive science. It turns up in neuroscience, strangely. It turns up in, the world of AI and robotics and neuropsychology and a host of other disciplines. And that just sort of fascinated me. And in a way, what I wanted to try and do with the book is kind of join the dots between those different disciplines and try to bring them together, because they're sometimes, for obvious reasons, highly specialized disciplines, somewhat siloed, you might say. And so the book is an attempt really just to try to bring in an accessible way the contributions of all those disciplines to a kind of a reset, as it were, around this mind-body question.
Well, you introduce this concept of embodied knowledge. You mentioned this a bit earlier, but this is kind of one of the big kind of points of a very kind of visible spine going through the whole book, embodied knowledge. And you link that with this kind of, I think it's a kind of quote you say, something about the body is the kind of competitive advantage we have as humans. So my kind of question is, well, what is embodied knowledge? Why is it important to understanding where we are about humans and intelligence and behavior? Where does it sit and what is it?
The ultimate irony of writing a book that tries to make explicit this sort of implicit knowledge that we have. In brief, I suppose embodied knowledge is the sort of knowledge we acquire when we immerse in the world, when we experience it directly. It's also knowledge that our body acquires through kind of the repetition of tasks, or at least the repeating or the exposure to repeated experiences of a similar or slightly different kind. It's probably easiest to sort of explain what embodied knowledge kind of looks like through a practical example, which will actually allow me then to kind of explain why I think it gives us some advantages. If you think of a pianist or an artist or a sportswoman, a lot of what they are able to do is to perform tasks to perform, you know, at immense levels of kind of sophistication without applying much conscious thought to what they're doing. And they can do that because, in simple terms, their body knows what to do. You know, so the tennis player can hit a ball that's coming at her at almost the speed of, you know, the time it takes for her to blink from coming from the server's racket at the other end of the court. And her body knows exactly where that ball's going to be and how to hit it back. You know, when somebody throws us a frisbee, you know, we don't have to do complex calculus, but we know roughly where we need to be to intercept it. And the point about it is that when you have that sort of knowledge, you can apply your conscious thought, if you will, to other aspects of the task that you're engaged in. So a pianist doesn't have to sit and think and worry about what her hands are doing on the keyboard, but can focus on the music that she's trying to make, the tonality, the speed, you know, where she's at versus the orchestra she's playing with. And so for me, what's brilliant about embodied knowledge is that it runs in the background and allows us to pay attention to other aspects of our daily performance that perhaps matter more than the more, as it were, the more mundane aspects of that performance. So hopefully that it helps explain what embodied knowledge is, but where we apply it, but also why it has some advantages, as it were. Why, when we have it, we're able to do things that are, that are pretty amazing.
But you describe then embodied knowledge. It should be a key thing or a key importance for business leaders or policymakers or those in politics, for example. So can you maybe talk through that? How or why is embodied knowledge important for the everyday business leader, policymaker, politician or political thinker?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'd start almost by saying, why is it important for all of us? And I think, one thing that when we have embodied knowledge of something, if it's of a pottery wheel or a tennis racket and a tennis court and a tennis ball and an opponent the other side of the court from us, what it allows us to do is to act, not necessarily instinctively. I think instinctively is a decent enough word to describe it, to act intuitively. So in other words, we understand the world around us, we understand the environment, we understand what's going on at such a great level that we don't necessarily have to default to thinking about things. And why that's, I suppose at some levels you might say, well, that's dangerous if business people and politicians don't think. And there are manifold examples of politicians that don't think around us that act intuitively. But often I think we're confronted with a world that's very difficult to predict. We're confronted with situations we've never seen before. It's either not possible because we don't have time, or it's not possible because we don't have necessarily the right frames of reference to make a judgment call. And so embodied knowledge is sort of useful for everybody because it allows us to react in more instinctive, intuitive ways. And it goes back to this distinction, I think, between explicit and sort of more embodied or implicit knowledge. So what I've seen by, our attempts at Stripe Partners to give our clients kind of embodied knowledge of a world that they need to act on or act in is the research can often ask a series of questions and people can return with a series of answers to those questions. But it's very unlikely that all of the answers that you get are going to satisfy you in all cases or for long periods of time. Circumstances always change. And so what we've seen is that when we sort of give people an opportunity to develop an embodied understanding of a phenomenon or of a social world, they're able to make much better decisions about what they or their business or their team should be doing because they have this kind of deep, kind of sedimented understanding of what was going on and what the right decision may be. And so for me, it's not necessarily the power of it, isn't necessarily the instinctiveness. And we can talk about why instinctiveness is sometimes dangerous, but it's this wide field of view that they've got of something, of a world that expands far beyond perhaps the narrow questions that they might have been asking or asked others to find out for them. And that's powerful. So it gives them some sense of peripheral vision, if you will.
There's a lovely story about a school janitor in your book. And you kind of talk about the school building in Oregon and in the US, and how we can learn. I think you say something about how we can learn more from this experience or that school janitor's experience than say from Google server farm should we all be observing school janitors then to make sense of?
Yeah, I mean, the janitor came from a team at Intel actually that were working in a they were working to kind of build, you know, sensor networks that could help understand schools and schools as environments, and the logic was, you know, if we put enough sensors in this environment, we can manage it better, we can manage it cheaper, and the school building was very old, and the windows were leaky, and the doors didn't quite shut, and the kids fiddled around with the radiators, and I think we all kind of accept that sort of buildings have personalities. They sort of, you know, pipes behave in certain ways, and they make certain noises, and they suggest, those noises suggest certain things, and we learn what they suggest over time, and the story of the janitor is really the story of a person who got sort of displaced by a sensor network that got installed in his public school, and ended up leaving his job because he felt disenfranchised by it. But the exercise of instrumenting this building was essentially a failure because, you know, the complexity of this old building just simply couldn't be adequately mapped through sensors and data analytics. And so for me, I suppose it's you know, an example I use early on in the book, because I think it's a good example of the ways in which, you know, this very difficult to describe knowledge that we can have about an environment, a world, a phenomenon, can often far surpass, you know, the knowledge that a decent slodge of data can provide us. So it's, I suppose it's not a book that's saying big data bad, you know, embodied knowledge good per se, but rather we need a bit of both, and we need perhaps a little bit more balance in how we think about understanding and making sense of the world.
It kind of leads on to my next question, because I was going to kind of say that, you know, people hear about this book and listen to this podcast and start thinking, well, you look, you know, with AI and big data and driverless cars and whatever, wearable technology, not even wearable anymore, but surely the body is going to become less relevant to making sense of who we are or what it is to be human.
Yeah, well, I hope not. And I hope that the book offers in some limited way a kind of corrective to that. I mean, you know, I think it's always easy to assume that, you know, there's a lot of that narrative around at the moment that technology is coming after us and we're all going to lose our jobs. Yeah, there are certainly some jobs that will be displaced. I think the case of autonomous cars, though, is a really good example, and one that I talk a lot about in the book, because driving is an incredibly complex thing to do, and we do it without thinking about it, and we're probably never quite as good at driving as we think we are or we say we are, but we, most of us who can drive, do it pretty well given the complexity of it. And what's become increasingly clear is that many of the sort of outlandish claims that the tech companies working on autonomous vehicles made, that they would get so-called level five autonomy. So a car that could drive kind of on any roads at any time in any conditions is a very, very, very long way off. And in fact, it's more likely than not that we will have to make environments that are suitable for autonomous vehicles. In other words, you know, the environment will have to change in order to support the limited capabilities of autonomous vehicles. So I think what the case of autonomous vehicles show is the limits of kind of computational thinking at one level, but also point up the you know, the power of embodied knowledge to allow us to perform a task like driving in very different and ever-changeable conditions without much bother, right? And it's, and that for me is sort of incredible in a way, right? I think whenever you see someone highly skilled that can do something with their hands or even just a mundane task like driving, it's worth stepping back and thinking, that's kind of incredible. And, you know, you've got a lot of dollars and a lot of clever people working on this challenge, and they haven't really been able to get anywhere near the level of proficiency that a human can get to. And I think that's kind of worth remembering and, of course, celebrating.
I was, it got me kind of thinking of certainly people I know who are expert, skilled artisans in either the use of stone or glass, and the relationship they have with the material that they use.
Yeah.
Was that they're listening to it, they're feeling it, they are working with it. It's a kind of communication between the two to make then certain rational decisions.
Yeah.
Based on what they're going to do and how they're going to, you kind of, it got me thinking, well, how does that work with that kind of world of AI or robots? You know, when you've kind of got that artisan relationship, it seems to, you can't fathom it. You can't.
I think this is the fundamentally difficult thing of writing a book about this sort of knowledge, right? That, you know, I talk about, yeah, it's a famous study of firefighters. It's like, they just sort of knew, this firefighter just knew that the building was going to collapse, right? It's very difficult for him to describe, like, why it was going to collapse, but he just had this sense. And, you know, of course, at many levels, you know, we're not encouraged to follow that kind of intuition anymore, right? We've got to look for the data points. And yet, yeah, whether it's a craftsman or a farmer or, you know, just a police officer looking at a crowd and going, okay, like, which way is this one going, right? You know, yeah, you can apply data to that, but can you? Possibly, possibly not. Not in the sort of time frames where decisions have to be made. And, you know, for me, this all kind of comes back philosophically to this idea that we inhabit the world through our bodies. We perceive the world through our bodies. Our bodies are kind of, forget the five senses. You know, we have many more senses. We are sensor laden. And we use that pack of sensors, as it were, and the connection between, you know, what our body can feel and what our brain can kind of make sense of, you know, to inhabit the world and to understand it. And that allows us to make, you know, incredibly fine-tuned kind of decisions and make sense of things. You know, a farmer can look at a grain of corn and a head of corn and say, not quite ready to harvest yet. You know, yeah, they can put that in an analysis device and work out its moisture level and make a decision as well. But, you know, there are a bunch of other factors. So it's that multiplicity of other things that we need to take account of, where our judgment is important.
I kind of also was reading into your book a lot, and because personally it's something I'm interested in and I use a lot when I'm working and coaching with leaders, but that kind of micro-sociological interaction performance aspect of the body as well, something Irvin Goffman spoke a lot about around the presentation of the self, that this is very much an unconscious thing, but it's the body that's actually doing the communicating.
Yeah.
How, you know, of course, what we say and but these multiple selves we have, and this isn't going necessarily into the mind and that dichotomy, but that really stood home, came home to me, was how fundamental the body is in also a communication tool.
Yeah.
In our everyday existence. So it's embodied the knowledge, but it also knows how to kind of communicate the knowledge.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think, so it goes back to kind of a motivation for writing the book, which is that, you know, an anthropologist, at least in the old sort of way of thinking about it, you know, goes to this remote village and is struck by how different everything is, and a lot of that difference is experienced through the body. It's the way that people hold themselves. It's you know, the ways in which people express emotion. It could be, as it was for me in India, just, you know, the simple bodily positions that people adopt. You know, for example, you know, waiting at a railway station, or the way that a woman may respond to a male from a different family in her environment, in a home, and, you know, the emotions of charm and of shame, you know, that she might feel or feel compelled to feel culturally, get expressed and experienced through the body. So, I think it's... you know, our roles and our identities get, you know, not only kind of communicated through kind of bodily praxis, as it were, but, you know, our sense of who we are is very bodily too. And again, it's a good example, I think, of kind of where other disciplines kind of feed into, you know, what at core is a kind of anthropological or sociological way of thinking, that, you know, there's growing evidence that our kind of bodily posture does influence how we feel. So a famous experiment, which I talk about in the book, with Botox given to people with depression, and with a couple of Botox injections, these people weren't able to frown. And it turned out that people that can't frown are not so sad anymore, right? So, you know, it's a very simple demonstration of why, of how your body shapes kind of what you think or how you feel.
I remember reading that about the Botox, and that was the time when I said, okay, I think I'm going to put the book down now and just let that one sink in, because that was a very, very powerful example. We're both anthropologists, so when I especially come across a chapter that has the title Observation, I get very excited. But, you know, I think you explained very well there, but what you're really saying in that chapter is that observation is not about looking, or not just about looking.
Yeah.
So what is observation?
Well, observation for me is, yeah, it's not just with the eyes. And I think, you know, there's a long tradition in kind of Western thought of, you know, very ocular-centric, very eye-centric way of thinking about how we perceive or make sense of the world. You know, so what I try to do in that chapter, I suppose, is to outline, you know, why it's the case that the body more generally is involved in acts of observation. So it's multisensory, and not limited merely to the sort of visual realm. And it requires something that, you know, is an article of faith for most anthropologists, which is you need to go somewhere. You need to be in the world that you want to understand. And I suppose my argument is that being in the world that you want to understand means taking your body into that world, right? It doesn't mean putting on a VR mask. It doesn't mean having somebody else do it. It doesn't mean watching a movie about it. It means going there and seeing and feeling and smelling it and soaking it up. And the soaking it up is a kind of is a good way of thinking about it, because there are so many clues and cues and stimuli in any environment that we're uniquely, as a species, uniquely kind of able to take in, to make sense of. We're not necessarily always aware of all of them all of the time, or even aware of any of them at that moment. But together, we kind of can recompile them, as it were, reflect on them, and make sense of, as you could say, a kind of a gestalt, right? So that kind of total picture emerges. But central to it, you know, my assertion is that central to this activity is going there, being there, and getting amongst it. And, you know, in later chapters of the book, in the more practical kind of applied bits of the book, you know, I talk about the importance of that, you know, for people in business and beyond.
And that kind of feeds in nicely to also what you talk about with embodiment and embodied knowledge, but empathy as well. And empathy, as we both know, is this wonderfully bounded buzzword in the business leadership, innovation, design thinking, carry on word that kind of has, it feels like, lost its meaning. And something that I personally resent the fact that, in a way, empathy hasn't really been understood.
Yeah.
And if we link that into observation, you know, on the one hand, what I really like what you're saying, I think a lot of time it's empathy is about kind of walking in the shoes of your customer or your employees, right? Well, yes, but if you use your metaphor of soaking it up, you need to do something with that. You can either go to the sink and squeeze out the sponge and do nothing with what you've soaked up, or there's a process of being quite reflective on who you are. And I'm just one, you know, I'm just kind of thinking about, with that embodied knowledge, how does that link in with empathy?
So I think the way, you know, a lot of the, you know, common or garden ways in which we think of empathy is it's almost a sort of psychological, you know, phenomenon or construct. So it's, people may talk about walking in other people's shoes, but ultimately I think what they're trying to imply is I'm getting into your head, and that's a, you know, that's a noble ambition. The way I approach empathy in the book is more of a, more embodied. It's more of something that comes through physical immersion in other people's worlds, or in physical experiences that might act as good proxies for somebody else's world. So I don't talk about it in the book, but there's a lovely example that I tried to squeeze in, which is somebody I met from a leprosy charity. Leprosy is a disease that kills the nerves in your fingers. So over time, you basically lose feeling. And when you lose feeling in your hands, you can't actually, you just don't have that dexterity. So this man does a lot of education with kids in schools, and you know, he can deliver lots of factual information about what it's like to be a leper and what it's like to have this disease. And that's great, and that's useful, and we need that sort of explicit factual knowledge. And then what he does with the kids is he has them wear different sorts of gloves and then try to open books. So first they put on a pair of woolly mitts, and he says, turn to page 89, and they kind of do that. And then he gives them a pair of kind of oven gloves, and they struggle a bit. And then he gives them a pair of kind of wicket-keeping gloves, and they can't do it. And what that physical sensation of what it may be like to have, you know, very little nervous feeling in your hands is, what it does, I think, is it primes you for other forms of knowledge. So the combination of that sort of very physical experience of something with a more factual explanation of what's actually going on, the facts of the matter, combined to create something sort of very powerful in combination with each other. And so for me, empathy is about a bit more than just walking in other people's shoes. I think it's about vulnerability and really putting yourself potentially in, you know, in environments that may be both physically discomforting, but also, but maybe psychologically or socially uncomfortable for you. And I think it's easy to sort of think of empathy as something kind of glib that you can access without much risk. And I think, yeah, I think we need to be encouraged to have a bit more discomfort, if you will, be out of our comfort zones.
But I think that, you know, we've had many conversations in the last few months, sharing our lived experience, but also our anthropological kind of observations and thoughts around COVID-19. And if you think what you're building on what you're saying around being in spaces and situations which are uncomfortable, it seems that we've been navigating that, or society, countries, neighborhoods,
yeah,
all the time. And I was kind of thinking, you know, the body has been, if anything, central to this, or central to the debate. There's the body over there, which has been politicalized, which is very much around being a good citizen and how you use public spaces, if that's jogging, or do you wear the face mask or not? And, you know, overnight you become antisocial or a kind of stigmatized being. Then it's the politicization also, and we've had Black Lives Matter come in, and whether sports people take the knee or not, and it's all the death of Black people, and the body again there being very much a thing. But kind of going more into the granular of everyday and the everyday world of business, that kind of, I'm just wondering where embodied knowledge sits now with the early stages potentially of the normalization of Zoom and that type of thing, and also the kind of almost forest fire of narratives around what is the future of the office, and everyone trying to claim maybe some rational forward thinking. So where's the body in this?
Where's the body? Yeah, I mean, I think in the context of sort of the renormalization, I mean, actually taking it in a sort of slightly broader view, I think personally I've been very struck by, I subscribe to this idea that you experience the world primarily, or at least first, through your body. That's our anchor in the world. And, you know, as I've sort of reemerged out of rural East Sussex back into London and been to restaurants and once or twice, and being confronted with a very different script, if you will, for how you navigate those spaces, what you're meant to do, you know, the absence of full, you know, facial sight of the person serving you in a restaurant, you know, new ways in which your body is meant to sort of, you know, be confined or operate in a space. So, you know, the body is very much on the front line of how we're making sense of these new COVID secure scripts of life, if you will. I think in the context of work, what, despite the excitement of the end of the office narrative, I think what we are discovering is that, you know, simple things like mood are very embodied. You know, it's very difficult to kind of judge the mood of a company. Our company's 25 people. Yeah, what's the mood? Well, when we're all in the office, the mood is there for us to sense and to feel without even thinking about it. When we're no longer in the office, it requires us to, you know, make calls to people and say, "How are you doing?" You know, we know how people are doing just by looking at them. Our bodies are very legible to us. So I did worry a few months ago that the office was going to die. I think the office is very much here to stay. I think the interesting challenge is actually how to manage a hybrid in which some people are working from home and some people are working in offices. And I think some will have bodies in play and some won't. And I think that's going to introduce interesting, uneven playing field for us to all operate on.
Well, Simon, thank you so much. I can highly recommend that people, listeners, read this book, because although Simon wrote it before any sign of COVID-19, It's totally relevant to making sense of this extremely gigantic cultural shift we're all experiencing. Now, Simon, keeping to tradition, I give all my guests the anthropologist's notebook to take away and study any topic, industry, or company they want to for 1 year. Mm-hmm. So what will you be doing with the notebook, Simon?
Well, I've long harbored a sort of fascination of, you know, the world of trading, of trading floors, of kind of the old investment banks. And I know one of your previous guests has probably pit me to the post. I mean, there are other ethnographies too, but Daniel Boynes' book is excellent. I've just finished it. But I've always, that's always been on my bucket list as an anthropologist, partly because I find that world just sort of opaque and just sort of fascinating. It's just a job that I'd, a set of jobs, a profession that I'd love to sort of understand because it has such influence on the world around us. And I think it would be kind of exciting and challenging to make sense of it. So that's still on my bucket list. Been there a long time. So if there's anybody in a financial services institution that wants to ask me to do it, I'd love to.
Well, you know, now there's a notebook beside it, so it will have to be activated at some point. So I do hope that you'll be able to get into that culture. Yeah. And, you know, Simon, thank you so much, and it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Decoding Culture podcast. I hope that you found the conversation with Simon interesting and will help you in your professional and also personal lives. Please do subscribe to the new podcast feed, and please feel free to give the podcast a rating on iTunes. To keep up to date with interesting trends on culture, business, anthropology, and also the training courses I'm running, then to sign up to my Decoding Culture newsletter. You can also follow me on LinkedIn and Twitter. All the links you need will be in the show notes. Thank you.